Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
E-Lynn, what are you doing listening to part two of our Knowing Me, Knowing Your Life special from the Prince Charles Cinema in London's Leicester Square last month before you've listened to part one? Oh, you have listened to part one. Oh, that's absolutely fine then. If you haven't listened to part one yet, make sure you go and listen to that first. Otherwise, you might not know what's going on in part two. And remember, next week we'll be back with the last in the current series of Monkey Tennis with our live interview with Simon Greenall. Simon was an amazing sport. He was really funny. So you won't want to miss that. So make sure you come back next week. And now, on with part two.
Monkey Tennis.
It's Knowing Me, Knowing You with Alan Partridge.
And Christ.
Monkey Tennis.
Please, please don't take my chat away from me.
The cracker's on fire aboard the pool! Monkey Tennis.
My house is open, my mock-up house.
Monkey Tennis.
That is a very nice action.
Oh, pardon.
Monkey Tennis.
300k. 300k all we take is a sky.
3 years ago, hobnobs were probably the number one biscuit.
Ho, ho, ho!
Monkey Tennis.
Yeah, so there you go. That's Nick sponsored by the Norwich Tourist Board.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
More product placement for them.
So there's a lot of visual gags in the Christmas in Norwich VT.
Oh,
firstly,
it's so good. It's
firstly,
so good.
Presumably, it's been filmed nowhere near Christmas. He's in tiny shorts running around, seemingly not getting that cold. And there's also the bit where he talks about Norwich Cathedral is breathtaking, and the shot shows it literally covered in scaffolding, like barely any of it's visible.
So the VT, so obviously introduces Norwich City Mustard and Shoes, and then you've got the visuals of Norwich Market Square, which I think are featured in Alan stuff three times probably. So you've got this show, you've got Alpha Papa obviously, and the Welcome to the Places of My Life as well. So I mean, it makes sense, it's featured quite a lot. But the jogging around the cloisters I think is amazing. That's one of my favourite bits, and it's particularly the line 300k we take it to Sky.
Brilliant.
And you'll notice that 300k figure does come back later in the episode.
Yes.
It's almost like that's the only figure Alan has to reference. He's plucking things out of the air.
It's
mathematically
sound. Also, one of my favourite quotes from the whole episode is his voiceover, and he says, six friars were beheaded on this site, which is now a Dorothy Perkins.
Yes. So they try and recreate the feeling of a historic battle in Norwich by just adding on some kind of mumbled sound effects and just zooming the camera and shaking it about.
Shaky cam footage of Next and Radio Rentals. I've got three semi-interesting Radio Rentals facts if you want them.
Oh, only if they're semi-interesting.
Yeah, I don't want fully interesting.
All right, they're definitely not fully interesting.
Well, we're
one, it still exists in Australia. Two, it peaked with 500 stores and 2 million customers. That's more than Waitrose and roughly equivalent to Argos. Three, it merged into Box Clever and went bust in 2003. That's the end of the Radio Rentals section of the evening.
See, I... I just love this kind of, just really reminds me very much of the mid-90s, because obviously with radio rentals, for those that might be too young to remember, this is literally, yeah, there we go, Tom Stab is too young to remember.
I don't remember that at all.
I don't know if that's true, but obviously, it sounds mad to say it now, but people used to rent the TVs, so they're 36-inch TVs they would rent and pay per month or whatever.
Madness.
So what me and my friends at school used to do is, one of my friends had one of those remote control watches, so you could basically turn the volume up on TVs, so you could just make it find the right signal for
it. I smell mischief brewing.
Yeah, so, well, basically, that's what we did on the walk home, just walk past radio rentals, turn it full volume on TV and run away.
Get out.
And we got taken to headmaster. For that, so we got busted.
A simpler, happier time.
Yeah, better days. Yeah.
You get a quick glimpse of Alan's car. As we know, Steve Coogan's an auto enthusiast, so we always like to look at the cars that he used. I put the reg into We Buy Any Car. It's a Rover bought in 1994. It's now valued at £50.
Ooh. Brilliant.
Should have bought that.
We'd buy together.
And obviously, there's an extra Rover joke there. There's excessive shots of his Rover Vitesse as he
Yes,
drops
it's
off.
It's almost like an advert, isn't it?
Yeah.
Got the big closing and everything. And I just made a note that the outfit he wears at hospital, which you can kind of see there, is it's brilliant. You've got a nice clash of colours there. You've got some red, some green, some yellow, some grey. It's terrible, but it's also bang on for 1995.
So,
important fact from the commentary about his visit to the local hospital to drop off some second-hand toys is that all of those children are genuinely sick.
Yeah.
True facts.
Ooh, that's not gone down very well, that. No. Not awful.
We didn't do it.
And you've got the balloons with his face on, which is a nice little touch. And I did note as well, when he turns up with a box full of toys, a lot of the toys are just falling out of the box, and he's just described them to the children as they're shop soiled as well. So substandard goods.
A reference that comes back in, obviously, in the Chocolate Oranges, Nightmare on a Partridge.
Yeah. And none of the kids say they've heard of him, which he finds a bit rude. Mm. And basically,
And says to them.
Yeah, he's a bit rude, actually.
A bit rude.
And basically what transpires is, because they've got no understanding of TV budgets, he's got nothing to talk to them about.
He says
that the set build for the mock-up of his house was 280k. Now, I've spoken to somebody that actually worked on the production of this TV show, more on that later, but they said the maximum you'd probably spend about 60 to 80k building a set like that. So, yeah, again, Alan is embellishing the figures there.
Is it a tax fiddle, do you think? And is this why in later years you find him throwing a shoebox of receipts off a ferry?
Great theory.
Nice
explains
theory.
A lot, explains a lot.
Could be it. He says that his budget is 280k for the set, and I wondered if that is perhaps why you see him negotiating while he's running through the cloisters earlier on.
For the 300k. Should we move on to Tandy?
Yep, and Alan unwinding. There's nothing relaxed. Even if you had the shop to yourself, I don't believe that you can unwind in Tandy. Even if I was in the Apple store on my own, I wouldn't be relaxing in there. I'd just be walking around in circles.
Well, that's because you'd be too scared, because you have to decide what iPhone you want, so you wouldn't be able to make the decision.
I've decided.
It's no new iPhone.
It's not happening.
Also, remember, this is Alan. He wants as little interaction with the general public as possible.
Yes.
And he wants to feel like an A-lister.
He wants to be adored by the general public, but equally he doesn't want to have to speak to them or interact with them in any way.
I think that's why even the shop staff have to basically stand in an awkward line until he needs someone to carry goods around the store for him.
And
a note from the commentary, genuine Tandy staff as well.
Brilliant.
I mean, that's just saving money. They don't have to employ extras. And I just stay back for 2 hours and do this.
Again, I feel like they've done an extremely good job as lay people rather than actors, because the looks on their faces, it really does look like they've been kept back unexpectedly, all desperate to get home to their families.
Speaking of looks on faces, there's one on Alan there. Yeah, that is brilliant.
That is so good.
He literally hands his coat and gloves to the staff as well. He's like, you can hold that.
And then he gives them his pile of purchases. Did anybody make a note of what Alan's buying in Tandy?
There's one that really stood out for me. I don't know if you guys agree, but he's buying a metal detector.
Not any old metal detector, a treasure finder.
A treasure finder.
To use the correct name.
Right.
So it looks to me like Alan here is buying two vintage replica phones, a metal detector called a treasure finder, the Travel Master, which is a 90s sat nav, which is massive.
That bit's cut from the Netflix version.
Oh, okay. Yep. Well, it's just watch it on the DVD. It's there. And also six boxes of floppy disks, and later six boxes of blank VHS tapes.
It's literally a graveyard of redundant tech.
Yeah.
There's a continuity error here as well. You see the manager carrying the vintage telephone around for him, but then in the next shot he's picking it up for the first time.
Yeah, I think it cuts back and forth because I think the VHS tapes appear and disappear a few times as well.
Okay. Do we reckon these are presents for other people or just for him?
No. Absolutely for him, aren't they?
I don't know, but I can imagine Alan gifting a box of floppy disks going, there you go, enjoy that.
My question to you would be...
I forgot to get something for Denise.
Given the ambivalence towards him by Fernando and Denise, and the fact that Carol's just left him, who would the presents be for?
Even better point.
Good question. All that storage for yourself, I'd say. Just keep using those floppy disks.
Yep.
Sure. Okay.
And also just one of my favourite lines in this Tandy section where he's playing with the stereo going, nice action, nice action. I've got one.
cut back to his house, which looks a little like Denton Abbey.
It does a little bit.
Isle, but
It's not, like, but it does look similar. But what I did enjoy is you can kind of see through the... through the windows by the door when he goes into the house, you can see the interior of that house has no similarities to the mock-up house whatsoever.
That is also not on the Netflix version, so Tom and I are not familiar with it, so you guys can
carry.
Bit
where he sort of oddly retreats into his own home and
then he's like peeking out around the corner. Yeah.
Says, you can't come in my house, it's private, but you will see me later in the mock-up.
Keen to stress.
So back in the studio, it's mulled wine and biscuits time.
Yes.
But the mince pies seem to be off. And Mary's eating them too loud. The commentary told me that is actually something that happened. Rebecca Front had to go from another rehearsal straight to rehearsals for this, and had been and basically didn't have any time to have lunch. The only thing that was there when she arrived was Boaster biscuits. So she was chowing down them, put Steve Coogan off some improv that he was doing, and basically said, "Please, can you stop eating so loud?" And then they worked that into the show.
And also, they do have a buttery swagger, so why wouldn't you want them?
Well, exactly.
So he goes on to chat to the hostesses about Hobnobs and Boasters. So he's just filling time here. He's idly chatting. It's terrible television by this point.
Don't look at us. Yeah, this isn't in the Netflix version.
In the Netflix version.
Nothing on this.
I just talked about it. Yeah. So,
talk about ourselves.
So, he talks about that. He says something like, 3 years ago, the Hobnob was the number one biscuit in the UK. So I have done a bit of internet research here.
Oh, so have I.
Well, according to a 2016 survey, the most popular biscuit in the UK was the chocolate digestive.
Oh, I had the same survey.
That's quite boring and disappointing, isn't
it? Chocolate Hobnob second place. Unlike Alan says, in the oatmeal kingdom, Hobnobs maybe don't rule the biscuit roost.
Obviously with this kind of filling time and the chit chat with the hostesses, you can tell he's trying to hit on them as well. He says to one of them, "You're doing very well, I've been watching you." Very creepy.
Quite a sinister
feel a bit horrible reading that out.
It's time for his star guest, apart from Mick Hucknall, that's contractual.
So at this point, before we go into his star guest apart from Mick Hucknall, would you like some Mick Hucknall fact bombs?
Oh, please.
Yeah, I think why wouldn't we want to? What we'll do, let's set a bit of context here. So in I, Partridge, when Alan writes about Hucknall coming on the show, he refers to his sexy trio of models called the Christmas Cracker, and Mick Hucknall had agreed to perform because he was, in his words, trying to bang one of them. So I spoke to Sam Taylor, who was the production coordinator on this show, so basically running all the kind of admin duties for the production team to make it all happen. So I asked her if she had any kind of like key memories or anything from the show. I'd really enjoyed this. So
I was worried you were going to say you asked her if Mick Hucknall was trying to bang everyone.
I mean, he might have been, but we didn't go down that route. She just said, so I think the way it transpired, Hucknall being on the show, was Coogan asked him directly because they were friends from kind of the Manchester scene. But Hucknall was just a massive fan of Alan as well, because obviously by this point Alan has been on TV quite a bit and it's been a success. That's in real life, not in Alan's universe, obviously. Yeah. Apparently Hucknall arrived early to watch the entire taping with an entourage, which was possibly members of Simply Red, but she wasn't sure on that detail.
No one knows who the ones are.
But, you know, very good point. I mean, I've got no idea.
You wouldn't know.
But in a normal TV recording, if you're doing the music performance at the end, you wouldn't be there watching the entire show. You'd be there for your sound check earlier, then you'd bugger off and come back a few hours later.
He's just
a
fan.
But he came down, watched the entire show, and they were all loving the Fanny Thomas "Ooh, pardon" line. Apparently they spent the entire day just quoting that the whole time, laughing their heads off what Sam said.
Who wouldn't?
Yeah, exactly. So back to the fact bombs on Hucknall, because some quite interesting stuff here. So I'm going to drop five facts for you.
Pow.
So Hucknall claims to have bedded over 3,000 women, although it's worth saying that is a claim, not a fact, I guess. I'll give you that.
Allegedly. It's a fact that he's claimed it.
Yes. Well, exactly, yeah. Simply Red's Stars album was the best-selling record in the UK in 1991 and 1992.
Wow.
No justice.
Well, I would have thought you quite like Simply Red, Nick.
No, be real.
I'm shocked considering your normal music taste.
Your music taste.
Simply Red have sold over 50 million albums. Mick Hucknall appeared on Question Time in 2014.
I saw that one, genuinely.
Was it a good show?
Yeah, it's right.
Okay, good. Also, possibly most bizarrely, Pelé is godfather to his children.
Yep.
That is true. I was at a charity fundraising dinner where I witnessed, the guest of honour was Pelé, I witnessed Mick Hucknall serenading Pelé. Yeah, he sang two songs to him.
What were the songs?
Oh, God, I can't remember. I was cringing in my seat. It was awful.
Well, there we go.
Yeah. Well, on to the star guest, apart from Hucknall, contractual.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll come back to Hucknall later, but for now, we'll crack on. Yeah.
There's so much more to say. Two very lovely golfers, but his introduction to Liz and Gordon Herron strongly implies that the only reason a man would be a caddy to a woman is that he's wheelchair-bound, which is classic yeah. and awful, Alan. So here they are. Patrick Marber was originally very worried about playing a disabled man, and a very uppity disabled lobby, in his words, got in touch asking why it couldn't have been a disabled actor. The reason given was that originally there was going to be some archive footage of him playing golf as an able-bodied man.
Yeah.
So there we go. Doon was wearing her own dress in this because she was actually pregnant, which they worked into the scene with Liz revealing her pregnancy.
Yeah, although I think, did they say in the commentary, you can't really tell anyway. It's not immediately obvious, I don't think, that she's pregnant, so they could have just not bothered. Anyway, my main note for this was, so he introduces Liz and Gordon as his star guest. A bit of a rubbish star guest.
Oh, yeah.
Especially considering Mick Hucknall was in the studio. Get him to do a chat. Yeah. He sold 50 million records.
And I do think, generally speaking, this section goes on for quite a while. And No Me Knowing You is absolutely brilliant, but I think this could have done with some of the... Bear in mind, they edited out some of the good stuff in the Netflix version. trim down this section, I'd say.
Yeah, I would say this is my least favourite part of the show. But anyway, loads more notes to get through on it.
Oh, God, don't stop you.
I've got a short note on naming conventions here. So Liz Herron was actually the name of a real friend of Rebecca Front's, who was apparently mortified. Know Me Knowing You, you have the two gay co-presenters of the show that usurps Know Me Knowing You, and Bridie McMahon. Yeah. That is a name from someone at the National Library because Patrick Marber just joined it and stole it wholesale off them.
So you have you've got a few repeated references in this interview section as well. So there's a second reference to a centipede, which I thought, is that kind of like lazy writing, or have they put that in? Is it Alan's character? He's got centipedes on the mind
I think he gets caught up on little facts he's been told, and I think it's entirely within character for him to have, he'll have read a book about centipedes that morning or something.
So Glenn's everything. Fingers are like centipedes, they're like centipedes. And also God is a gas, again. Not like Caligas.
Although now he's talking about it as if that is a stone cold
fact. That is another fact punch.
He was forced to come up with on the spot. They mentioned that that Liz won the Colgate Cup and was named Lady Sportsperson of the Year by the readers of She magazine. I wasn't entirely familiar with She magazine, so I did a little bit of digging. It did exist for 56 years until 2011. There's an article in The Economist about the submissions that they used to get, which I thought was quite interesting, so I'll just quote from it now. The deal was, if we accepted your manuscript, you gave us permission to change anything but the facts. Contributors were sent a proof before publication to check for errors that might have crept in. They sometimes felt that our editing had ruined a unique style. One author was so upset by minor changes to an otherwise excellent piece on his relationship with a celebrity that he demanded his name be taken off it. I had to point out there wasn't much point in our removing his name from a memoir headlined, I Am Barry Norman's Brother.
That is brilliant.
I wondered where you were going with that, and that was good.
Yeah. I'm glad the ramble was worth it.
So what else do we do? We get a bit of... Alan goes on to check whether Dr. Hook is a real doctor, which gets revealed.
Yeah, which we do GP. Find out.
Yes, not just yet, but we do find out.
I do have a question to the group. Who is your favourite doctor that's not a real doctor?
Ooh.
Any suggestions?
Dr. Dre for me, I think.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. I can't think of any others.
Gillian McKeith.
Gillian McKeith is a great
very good fictional doctor. I like what you've done there. Yeah.
It's Fox, it's Dre, it's McKeith.
Dr. Fox, yeah. Who
the
could
big
forget?
Three.
Yeah.
There's a lovely bit where Alan and Gordon are sort of sharing a creeping sense of Liz's personality washing over them as she becomes slightly irritating.
They kind of share a moment, don't they?
Yeah.
And even before that, you can see Alan is visibly bored when Liz is talking. But I think that is partly just... He's just a bit sexist sometimes in things like this as well.
Which goes against what happens later. Like, Gordon very quickly turns on Alan, but here they're quite pally. They're kind of on each other's side.
Oh, yeah. Well, so Liz has basically got to the end of a passage where she's been very cheerily incorrect about almost everything.
With her lovely bird laugh.
Yes. So Alan just says to Gordon, "Gordon, do you get out much?" And he wearily replies, When I can.
Yeah.
And then later he also refers to, "You're married to Liz. There's no escaping that." Quite a nice one.
So, and he refers to her lovely bird laugh, and it's a bit of a commentary of him complimenting something that's clearly winding him up. He doesn't think it's lovely. He hates it. That's the truth of the matter. I had a couple of notes about the paintings that you can see behind them here as well. So the portrait of Alan that Alan says is painted by David Morton. There actually is a real English painter called David Morton, but I don't think it'd be the same guy because the David Morton that I could find via the internet, his work is mostly abstract. His website says he began to paint in a non-realistic style in 1970 after studying the works of the Surrealists. So I don't think that would tie in with the portrait of Alan there.
The other painting, though,
bizarrely, this does not get referenced in the TV show whatsoever, but for those of you listening, you go and watch the show and you'll see what we're talking about. I'd say it's basically a depiction of a lady part. That's how they describe it in their commentary.
But
it's very weird that it's... I think, did they say in the commentary that there was supposed to be reference?
There was
going to
be
cut?
A bit that was cut. The idea is, according to the commentary, is that it's something that Denise did, which I think daughter-father obligation is perhaps why Alan has hung it up in his mock-up house, as well as perhaps his real home. Or maybe he's even made a concession to her saying, well, maybe not in the real house, but...
In the mock-up.
It's going to be
in the mock-up.
Yeah. Remember as well that this is a family show, Alan has stressed that. In this section, he goes on to talk about how he's known as Randy Gordon, that he's called Chairman Mao, and then Alan compares him to a Dalek because he can't get upstairs. Like,
all the while framed by an explicit painting of a vagina.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Keep it light.
The only other note I've really had is I just got a bit bored about halfway through this chat. I just think the section goes on too long.
I'd agree.
Just him being a bit obnoxious and crass to a guest with a disability was just a bit too much of an easy gag, almost.
The only other bit I kind of wanted to mention was he talks about Gordon as one of the many heroic disabled people and goes on to list Lord Nelson, Napoleon, Ironside, Daniel Day-Lewis, Captain Hook and Dave Allen. some genuine, some fictitious. But do we know what they were afflicted with, what their disability was? Lord Nelson.
I had a rough note of some of these.
Did his arm come off?
I think you might have to...
Did his arm come off?
just fell off, mate.
No, he was blind in one eye. Napoleon, I wasn't sure about this one. I had to do quite a bit of digging. But
short?
I thought it was something to do with his legs as well, but it's not. He had epilepsy. Ironside.
Was he tragically fictitious?
He's in a wheelchair because he took a bullet from a sniper. Daniel Day-Lewis, I wasn't sure, to be honest, unless anyone knows.
My left foot.
Yeah.
It's all coming together.
No, at least he's got some notes to give him his due. He's done something.
It's nice that Nick can learn from you guys as well as the other way around.
Yeah, giving something back. Captain Hook.
No hand. Lost a hand.
No hand.
Hook
yes, it's no hand. And Dave Allen.
I don't know that one.
I presumed it was the Irish comedian who was missing the very top of one finger.
I think it might just be more than the top, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That concludes Name My Disability.
So he says to Gordon Heron, in a sense, you were the victim of a leg thief, which is a very odd way of putting it.
Does he have much to say about this chat in the iPartridge book as well, I think?
The only difference in the audiobook and the physical book, in the book, Gordon is described as a Czech aplegic, so Alan has no idea what is actually wrong with him.
He never checked it.
And in the audiobook, it says paraplegic. The only thing, the fact he's been victim of a leg thief, I did some digging on what would happen if you actually did get struck by lightning. So only 1 in 10 Americans, this is American facts obviously, have died from being struck by lightning in the 3 decades between 1981 and 2010. You will likely lose consciousness from anywhere for a few minutes to a few years. You could suffer brain damage resulting in short-term memory loss or amnesia. Long-term issues include personality changes, learning disabilities, sleep disorders and seizures. So I would say that Gordon got off lightly.
I would agree.
Contrary to what you guys said about the length of this scene, there is one bit in this that is very fanciful, and it kind of... I simultaneously thought, I don't understand how this has appeared, but also was absolutely delighted by it. And it's basically the conversation that Alan has with Gordon about his hobby of drawing maps.
in his mind.
That are primarily of fictitious places and in his head. And then Alan, you know, to be fair, Alan has a real rapport going here. So he says, oh, you know, I'd love to walk around in your head. I'm sure it's very picturesque. And then Gordon stiffens and goes, well, you can't, it's private. So,
It's kind of a bit weird because it's not that funny. That like it's not a great payoff to that whole chat.
I thought the sort of the painting of the character is basically. I think it's quite relevant, and I think it's a little more subtle than some of the other gags, but I think they paint him as a well-rounded character, and I think it's maybe there's an implication that being struck by lightning has sort of affected him a bit behaviourally as well.
Maybe. Yeah.
This is getting too deep,
hey,
isn't it?
Maybe that's the joke. Well, I think we should move on to Christmas crackers. What do you think about that?
There he is.
That cracker is about the length of a small Chinese restaurant. That's Alan's words, not mine.
I love the metric that he uses. Yeah.
But see, I thought that was such a surreal reference point. I was like, my money's on that being a line from Amanda Iannucci, but apparently that was a line written by Patrick Marber.
The cracker's 5 foot high by 23 feet long.
Apparently. Yes.
Did anybody check whether this was the biggest cracker in the world? Is there a record anywhere?
I did.
Of course someone did.
The world's longest Christmas cracker measured 63.1 metres in length and 4 metres high, so a bit bigger than that one. The cracker contained balloons, toys, hat and a joke, and the cracker was pulled
by a hat singular.
It's a massive hat. Yeah.
And was pulled by the parents and children at Lay School in Buckinghamshire and went bang. Those are the actual words from the Guinness
Book. You'd want it to go bang, wouldn't you?
Those are the actual words from the Guinness
Book. Was that a requirement? That must have been a requirement.
What, that it went bang?
That it went bang, yeah.
Otherwise it doesn't count.
You know what, though? Sod all that. I think what everyone's probably thinking is, what's the biggest cracker we were able to find with minimal internet research? Would you like to know the answer?
Yes.
Adam, reveal the cracker.
Drum roll, please.
There it is. All 75 centimetres of it.
Yeah. If you're listening to the episode and you're not in the room with us, all I can say is it is colossal and impressive. It's taken, it's taken 16 of us to wheel it out on 8 trolleys.
We struggled to get it in the room, and much like Alan's cracker has his face on it, our faces are also on the cracker. I don't know if you guys can all see that in the room here.
Yep.
But you know what? We're not going to pull that now. We're going to save that for later, because what we thought we'd do instead... there are 100 crackers around the room, so those of you that have a cracker, if you can prepare, and we're going to do a mass cracker pool.
We're going to break the Guinness World Record for crackers pooled in this room tonight.
Yeah, biggest cracker pool on a podcast about Alan Partridge to
an
ever be recorded.
To make friends with your neighbours.
We have got members of the Guinness Book of Records in the room to validate this.
So, right, has everybody got their crackers ready? Some yes, some no.
Right.
Okay.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
3, 2, 1, pull your crackers.
Oh, yeah. Loved it.
God. That sounded great.
Damn, that was satisfying.
Bit of a delay.
Please feel free to put your hats on.
Yeah,
get in the
if you want to get
spirit.
Festive, save the jokes for later, but put a hat on. Do what you like with that.
Very glad that none of them have caught on fire.
Yes. Whereas with Alan's own cracker, obviously, it's smoking before the cracker pull even starts as well.
Yep. And also, the cracker they use in this episode did actually catch on fire.
Did really?
Genuine. Yeah, it did catch on fire in rehearsal.
Bloody White City pyrotechnics. You can't trust them with anything.
Interesting that I thought, so was this product placement of White City Pyrotechnics, or were they for some reason exempt?
Well, it doesn't exist, does it?
It's not real.
No, I think he was just trying to...
That's the joke.
Very good.
Are we ready to move on to breakfast bar chat?
Yes, let's do it.
Oh, hang on, no, I think we need to talk about the cracker joke, please.
Okay.
Alan trying to pull it back from the last minute at yet more product placement for Rover, as he knows he's in trouble. So Santa's back and asked Tony Hares, What make of Cargo's woof woof? Tony Hayes is way ahead. You can also see when you, on
see it through,
on screen,
yeah.
You can see that the answer is a rover. And then Tony Hayes, is it a rover? Alan, desperate. Help me out, mate. And then Santa's obviously like, no, this is some serious quick thinking from Santa. And going against all of his morals as a rover company man, no, it's a Vauxhall Labrador.
Fair play to Mike.
Well-known
to be fair.
Car.
Fair yeah. play to him.
So, yes, Breakfast Bar Chat. Where basically everybody gangs up on Alan to pay for the dialysis machine that was due to be donated if they broke the world record, which they obviously didn't.
Yeah, so the dialysis machine costs 20k. Tony Hayes says the show costs 300k. Also, the point we know that Alan lying about the set bill being 280, which yeah. would only leave 20k left for everything else. There's no way that's true. So I realise Gordon says to Alan, you could have got 14 dialysis machines instead of making this programme. The maths are wrong. You could actually got 15. Ah. Minor point, but there we go.
But it is...
that the joke?
Is that the joke?
I mean, we'll never know.
Who knows?
And then I'd love the bit where Alan says to Tony Hayes, I think if you ask the British public whether they would prefer 14 kidney dialysis machines or an Alan Partridge Christmas special, the answer would be pretty unanimous, wouldn't it, Tony? Tony responds, yes, I think it would.
It's a lovely bit.
Also in this section, you can see there are a few choir boys and stuff behind the breakfast bar that never actually made it onto screen. So I think we'll kind of get onto that with the 12 Days of Christmas bit.
Yep.
But I
yes.
think genuinely, yep. lots of extras that were planned to actually come out and... in real life, as well as in the show, it didn't happen.
They do say in the commentary a lot of kids were genuinely upset because they thought they were going to be on telly, and then they say,
and they
no,
probably spent a whole afternoon in the TV studio for nothing.
Yeah, yeah, life imitating art there a little bit. So are we on to the 12 Days of Christmas, or have you got more on the breakfast bar?
I'm
chat?
Ready to talk about 12 Days
it.
Of Christmas.
Oh, ignore that.
For those listening, nothing went wrong with the screens there. Everything is fine. Jed.
Oh, there's quite a bit of punching at this point, isn't there?
No, punching up
later on.
Yeah, yeah.
Later on.
We've got to do the 12 Days of Christmas first, which gets quite quickly abandoned, to be honest.
He cut straight to the song, and I wondered what the cue was, because in the run-up to that, he's yeah. literally just wandering around chatting about nothing, yeah. and it wasn't in the script.
Straight into the pre-recorded vocal, it's hilarious. And he only gets as far as the fourth day of Christmas, so he only gets as far as four calling birds, which I thought was a bit of a shame, because we all know five gold rings is the best bit, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
The cracker hasn't been moved, so you've got turtle doves that can't land and are perilously above
us. Just flapping aimlessly.
Yeah, although Alan does say, keep flapping, it looks good.
One of the turtle doves seems to be laughing as if she knows the whole thing's not real. She's broken the fourth wall there a little bit. And yeah, quite a few rounds of people were cut. Lots of children upset backstage that never made it onto
stage. Although Alan does say at this point, the show's still going well, I believe that. As long as he believes it, then it's fine.
Armando said on the commentary, was that bit funny or was it just tragic? To which the answer is, both, obviously. Back to Fanny Thomas.
Yes, I think so. Yep.
Or Peter Willis.
Yeah. Alan's really tiring of Fanny's innuendo and challenges her, saying, "What does your mother think of you?" Very proud. The innuendo ramps up until Alan cracks.
And I thought, then obviously Fanny removes the wig and is like, this is Peter. Thought it's a bit like the moment with Alan Ford in Naomi Knowing You. Yep.
Do you want to get sucked in?
Do you want to get sucked in, son? And I did anybody research Peter Willis? Any Peter Willises of note that we should know about?
Just generally the name Peter Willis?
Yeah.
No.
No, but okay. I do have a note on what they say in our iPartridge about Peter Willis, but carry on.
Well, basically, I couldn't find, because they say Peter Willis is a DJ, couldn't find any DJs, but the editor of the Daily Mirror appointed in 2016 is a Peter Willis.
Ah.
So probably not based on him.
No.
In iPartridge, Alan says that Peter is now the Michelin-starred chef proprietor of Just Willis, but at the time of Knowing Me, Knowing You, was suffering his own psychological meltdown, which manifested itself as him appearing as a transvestite called Fanny Thomas. He's sorted himself out now.
Okay. Armando says in the commentary that actually this character would be a good idea for a series. So question to the group, would you watch a Fanny Thomas series?
Could I probably know. Watch a one-off special.
Yeah. I was gonna say, is there room for a cookery mockumentary?
The innuendo gets a bit much, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Gets a bit tiresome, to use Alan's words.
I know we're not going to go down into an iPartridge rabbit hole, but there was just three key lines that I pulled out from the chapter on Know Me, Knowing You All that I think kind of sum everything up in terms of where Alan's mind's at. We owed it to Forbes to make the show. I'm confident the Beeb wanted the show anyway.
No.
I proved myself to be competent.
Yeah, that is a very neat summary, isn't it?
I thought it was quite ironic that at the point that Fanny slash Peter gets too angry to make use of any innuendos, that's the point that Alan meekly says, "I want Fanny." Sadly, the comic potential of that joke will never be fulfilled.
Yeah. We can probably move on to the punches now, I reckon.
Yeah. Let's move on to the punches.
I thought what I really like about this, when Gordon says to him, "What do you do for an encore, Shagger Robin?" The look on his face. He's literally decided, "I'm going to thump this guy." Yeah. Fuck it.
Yeah. But also, I mean, it's obviously the show's been a disaster from the moment it started. But
although Alan thinks it's gone well.
yeah, it's going well. This is the audience speaking, Tony. I just think the guests have clearly lost all respect for him. It's crumbling, isn't it? And they just start to savage him.
Yeah, so he deliberately punches Gordon Herron and then goes on to deliberately punch Tony Hares. Now, watching this a few times that I have recently, I notice Fanny Thomas picks up a massive pepper mill from the table, like she's ready to use it to batter Alan.
Yeah. On the pitch.
So I think Fanny thinks that Alan's coming for her next, basically. So she's ready to get stuck in for that.
Fanny is handy, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Ready to go.
I thought that was a great little detail I hadn't picked up on until quite recently.
There is some debate about the bird that Alan uses when he punches Tony Hares in the face. I mean, it looks like a partridge in terms of size.
Yep.
It's relatively small, and that would make comic sense given his name. But then David Schneider says in the commentary that this chicken didn't hurt at all. but the smell my cheese scene did in I'm Alan Partridge, because the fork actually went through the cheese and into his face.
Ooh.
And we've also seen in the script that it's referred to as a turkey, so it is very much a mystery bird.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah. Then Hare's responding to being thumped by Alan. He says, "I'm going to make sure you never, never work in TV again." It's delivered in such a hammy way, isn't it?
It's quite an unconvincing line.
Yeah. But
Alan just basically says, "I need help. I'll get help." Just desperate.
Spoiler, please don't take my chat away from me.
In I, Partridge, Alan goes into a bit of a section about is it ever wrong to smash a cripple in the face? They like that bit.
Goodness me.
Does that mean they agree?
He basically uses Osama bin Laden as a reason to justify it.
Wow.
Anyway, I like
that's a reach. Rebecca Front's character, I like that she's so polite that when he says, "Do you want some?" she says, "No, thank you."
Yeah, that's very good.
Rolling into the end of the show, it's another "and on that bombshell," as we've heard many times from Naomi Knowing You, and he says and hoost. Is hoost the word?
I think that's a genuine stumble over the words, isn't it?
I think so.
Interestingly, in Every Ruddy Word, it does say hoost. Is hoost even a word? So I don't know if they fixed that retrospectively in Every Ruddy Word.
Hoost is not a word according to the English dictionary.
It's not. I did also note with the second punch of the potential partridge, turkey, chicken, whatever, Hares is cold out on the floor, and he remains passed out on the floor for the entire duration of the show. How realistic is that? I don't know.
Who knew a partridge, turkey, chicken could be so devastating?
Exactly. And then quickly, just again in I, Partridge, Alan says, "Hares required emergency dental treatment, which Alan was happy to pay for, and that Hares was needlessly off with him in the days after the show."
So unreasonable.
So the show's fallen apart. It's another shambles for Alan, but he's just got time to let everybody know that he's told in his ear that Dr. Hook is not a qualified doctor.
So in case you were wondering, that is the answer.
Yes. And so we're on to the real star of the show, Mick Hucknall.
Yeah, the star guest. He is brilliant in this. Like, you can see the scared expression on his face. That's some quality acting.
He really does try to act with his eyes, especially as Alan crosses his path, face in hands, kind of making a weird cooing noise.
Yeah.
He's the only real celebrity ever to appear, isn't he?
Yeah.
In a Naomi Knowing You project.
Lots referenced, but very few that we actually see.
Lots of people accuse Mick Hucknall of singing out of tune in this bit, but the cast claim that it's actually Glenn was playing out of tune.
Glenn. Blame it on Glenn.
They also say that Mick Hucknall has a picture of Rebecca Front and Dune in his study that was taken on this day. A meaningful moment for Mick there.
He's a big fan. So I took us through some Hucknall facts earlier. Should we return to some Hucknall facts?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitive.
There we go. In a game that we'd all like to play with you all in the room tonight as well, it's time for a game that has nothing in common with Would I Lie to You? It's time for a game of Would We Lie to You?
Yes.
Jed, that should have been changed. That says would I lie, not would we lie.
Unbelievable.
Anyway, just ignore that. It's got nothing in common with the TV show.
Yep.
So here we go.
So, yeah, are you ready for some Hucknall facts? We will all give you a fact each. We'll recap, and then by the power of you guys making noise, we'll decide what collectively you think is the true fact.
So,
Adam.
Mick Hucknall has never eaten a pear due to a rare allergic condition.
Mick Hucknall had to cut off his dreadlocks after Martin McCutcheon was sick on them.
Mick Hucknall has his own winery, which produces a red wine called Simply Red.
And finally, Mick Hucknall of Simply Red is in fact colourblind and unable to see the colour red.
So just to do a recap there, which of these facts about Mick Hucknall is true? Is he allergic to pears? Did he have to cut off his dreadlocks after Martin McCutcheon was sick on them? Does he own his own winery, which produces a red wine called Simply Red? Or is he, in fact, colourblind and unable to see the colour red? So, how should we do this? Should we go?
Let's distill it down to pear, sick, wine, colourblind.
Like it.
So, okay. If we could get a cheer for pear.
About three people.
A couple there.
Sick.
Yay! Quite popular.
Wine.
Yay! Also popular.
Or colourblind.
I think it's between wine and sick, which is quite. Well,
Is it time for me to reveal mine as it got the lowest cheer?
Reveal.
It's a lie.
No stab cares. Reveal. Lie. Okay, so should we do a tie break? Is it wine or is it sick? Make some noise for wine. Make some noise for sick.
It's pretty even. Should we just do a big reveal?
I think sick's edged it, but we'll do a reveal at the same time. Ready?
Hey, there you go.
It's the Martin McCutcheon.
Martin McCutcheon was sick in his dreadlocks, and he had to cut them off after that. So, an interesting addendum. He does deny that, but I've spoken to somebody that knows that's true. So
yeah.
Bonus info.
We're prepared to go. Well, Tom Dark is prepared to go on the record. The rest of us would like to add the word allegedly.
Shit.
So, I
do mean allegedly. I just forgot.
What else on this episode before we get to our very special guest?
Well, there's just one very brief bit to wrap up at the end, because this is included in the Everybody Word script book. You have Alan's Country Ramble at the end, which to me implied like it was aired as part of the original show. But actually, it turns out this was originally aired as part of Christmas Night with the Stars in 1994, hosted by Fry and Laurie. Anyway, you just have, it's kind of like mocking introspective documentaries. So this is also on the Knowing Me, Knowing Your DVD as well, and on YouTube and what have you. So it's, yeah, basically Alan going rambling on his own on Christmas Day in Swatham.
I think it is really funny, but it has got a sort of tragic side to it once you know the context of Alan's family has essentially left him and isn't interested. Even when his family was with him, they weren't interested in going on a ramble, so he's off on his own.
And it's Alan trying to embrace nature, but then he stood in some woodland saying somebody should clean up these leaves. And he goes on to talk about, he says, it's beautiful here, but the nearest shop is over 2 miles away, which is a problem. And also proposes a series of vending machines in hedges. It finishes in a very melancholy style. He goes on singing "I'm a one-man band" because he's literally on his own on Christmas Day, and then walks off looking a little bit teary-eyed into
this. I would say this section and the end section of "Know Me, Knowing You" are very melancholy and a little bit tragic, aren't they?
Yep.
So
yeah,
yeah,
definitely, yeah, yeah.
Real tinge of sadness. This is a low ebb even for Alan.
So, should we wrap up in summary? What are our quick thoughts about "Know Me, Knowing You"?
I think it's a wonderful episode. I think that it gets very dark, but it never stops being fun. I think that you guys are maybe a bit hard on the old Liz and Gordon Heron. I think that there's some nice subtlety in that scene. Basically, it's more Partridge Gold. It's five Partridge Gold rings for Christmas.
Like it. I mean, yeah, I think for me, I could easily lose the Liz and Gordon Heron bit. I don't really care for that too much. But then the Christmas in Norwich bit is one of my favourite Partridge kind of VT pieces. So, yeah, it is great. Just lose those 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'd watch it and do watch it every single year. I just appeal to Netflix to put the full version up there. So,
are you listening to us, Netflix / BBC?
Yeah.
And they're not.
Yeah.
IMDb, this is a rating of 8.3 out of 10 from 177 reviews at time of publication. I don't know. And I'd probably go in line with that. I think it's good.
Yep.
Fantastic.
And it is just weird that, you know, there's just no mention of him shooting and killing a man live on air throughout this entire show.
Just gloss over it. It's Christmas.
Yeah, it's fine. Keep it light.
Anyway, that's the end of our dissection and discussion and celebration of Knowing Me, Knowing You. It's time to introduce tonight's very special guest.
Hi, listeners. Me again. So that wraps up the Knowing Me, Knowing You section of our live podcast recording. Thank you so much to all of those that bought tickets and made it down. We had an absolute blast doing it, and if you're listening to this, you've experienced it twice. Lovely stuff. Next week, we'll be back with the last episode in the current series, featuring our interview with Simon Greenall. If you weren't there, you won't want to miss this. Not only was Simon funny, but it turns out he's educational too. All will be revealed next week. See you then.
Monkey tennis? It's knowing me knowing you with Alan Partridge.
And Christ.
Monkey tennis?
Please, please don't take my chat away from me.
The cracker's on fire above the pool!
Monkey tennis?
My house is open, my mock-up house.
Monkey tennis?
That is a very nice action.
Oh, pardon?
Monkey tennis?
300k. 300k all it takes is a sky.
3 years ago, hobnobs were probably the number one biscuit.
Ho, ho, ho!
Monkey tennis?
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.